Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, three writers of romance, Sajni Patel, Scarlett St. Clair, and Helene Wecker, discuss the role of religion in the romance genre. This conversation originally took place July 10th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's new special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and our programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets is now open. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? My name is Carrie Cramson. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. I'd like to welcome you all to the program. And speaking of new initiatives, tonight's program is part of our new series, American Prophets, which examines the intersections of writing, religion, and culture. American Prophets covers everything from religion in American history to how comedy, science fiction, horror, and poetry writing address the idea of spirituality. We're here tonight to talk about romance writing and religion and the way in which authors of love stories deal with their characters' religion, tell the stories of historic religious figures, and explore their own history of faith in their work. Sajni Patel is an award-winning author of romance and young adult novels and is perhaps best known for her debut, The Trouble with Hating You. Her critically acclaimed YA dark fantasy, A Drop of Venom, from Disney Hyperion's Rick Riordan Presents, fuses the Medusa myth with Indian mythology in what Booklist calls a furious, action-packed fantasy and Publishers Weekly calls urgent and vital. Number one New York Times best-selling author Scarlett St. Clair is a citizen of the Muscogee Nation and the author of Hades X Persephone Saga, my apologies, the Adrian X Isolde series, fairy tale retellings, and When the Stars Come Out. She has a master's degree in library science and information studies and a bachelor's degree in English. She is obsessed with Greek mythology, murder mysteries, and the afterlife. Her new book is Terror at the Gates. And Helene Wecker is the author of The Gollum and the Genie and The Hidden Palace. Her books have appeared on the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle's bestseller lists and have won a National Jewish Book Award, a VCU Cabal Award, and the Harold U. Ribelou Prize, and the Mythopoeic Award, as best I could do. They're joined in conversation by Amanda Anderson, the owner of Last Chapter Books, and we want to welcome them all here for tonight's program. Thank you very much.
Wow. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Amanda. I own the Last Chapter Bookshop, and I am so honored to be moderating these amazing people and to hear all about their books and talk about some great topics. So I'm going to have the authors go through and introduce themselves, tell you a little bit about their most recent book and what they are currently working on.
My name is Scarlett St. Clair. My newest book is Terror at the Gates. It's a Lilith-inspired retelling. Lilith as an archetype, really, not Lilith as, like, the demon. I'm not working on anything right now because I can't think beyond this day. So, yeah, the end.
Hi, thanks for coming. I'm Helene Wecker. My most recent book that has been published is called The Hidden Palace, and that is the sequel to my first book, which was called The Golem and the Genie. The book that I am working on right now is the third book in the trilogy, title currently being wrangled over by myself, my agent, and my editor. So currently it's just called Book Three. And that is coming out this time next year.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sajni Patel. Thank you, too, for being here. My latest release is called A Touch of Blood, which is a follow-up or companion novel to A Drop of Venom, which is my Medusa retelling where I mix Greek mythology with Indian lore. A Drop of Venom and A Touch of Blood is a Persephone and Hades retelling, but Indian. And I'm currently working on IP, which is intellectual property, that I can't talk about because it's very like NDA protected, but I hope to talk about it soon.
Isn't Star Wars?
No.
Awesome. Well, thank you all. So our first question is, why is religion relevant to romance writing? How has that relevance changed since you began writing and reading in the genre? You want to start this way? Shake it up.
Oh, me first? Yeah. Shake it up. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a two-part. I'll do like the first one.
Okay,
then we
thank
can.
You.
I got you. Why is religion relevant to romance writing?
I think religion is, it can be like a way of developing the character, like just another layer to make your character more nuanced and to create like multiple facets of the layer of the character. But if you want to go deeper into the character, it can also, you know, support their decision making, the way that they think, the things that they do. And in a romance, it might also lead the way to how they interact with their love interests. So like, for example, in my debut, The Trouble with Hating You, my characters are Hindu or have a Hindu background. And so it starts out with the family wanting to set them up because that's how things are done traditionally. But then, you know, they take into their own hands. And yeah, I think it's just, it's a great way to, and it's also a great way for readers to learn about other religions and cultures. Not that I'm saying that my job as a writer is to like teach people about my culture, but if I'm having it in the book, you know, and you've never been exposed to it, then you can understand it a little bit better, just like any other character.
Yeah, just building on that, like, that's basically it. It's like, okay, you've got romance, you've got two people trying to like suss each other out. It's religion, religious elements of like, okay, what was your, you know, got an upbringing, you've got a culture that goes along with that, you've got core beliefs about, you know, immorality, God, or lack of God, or gods. You know, this is all sort of at the heart of who we are as people. So like, when you're looking at characters in a romance, okay, who are you falling in love with? Who are these two people? Like, what is the package? And that is certainly like, a huge part of the package of a person of is like, you know, your religious upbringing or lack thereof and everything that comes along with that. So, and in my books, it's come at from a slightly different angle because the two love interests are, they're monsters. They are an actual golem, which is a person created out of clay in Jewish mythology, and a genie, as in like, you know, genie out of a bottle. And so they, you know, they meet in 1899 Manhattan and they have to get to know each other, and they have incredibly different belief systems about like who they are and their role in the world and what, you know, what the world has done to them or the path that the world has set them on. And they are dictated in some ways by their communities, you know, the Lower East Side Jewish community on the one hand and the Arab American community of Little Syria on the other. So they have very, very different belief systems, but they are both outsiders. And that is the thing that connects them above all else. So it's sort of that push and pull that I think religion can bring to characters, whether they are in the same belief system or from two different belief systems. It's like, okay, what's going against each other and what's connecting them?
Yeah. It's interesting. I think for romances, especially like the kind of romance I write, which is very, very steamy, you know, I feel like religion oftentimes paints women as the ones who have to be pious and well-behaved, and we can't engage with our sexuality or sensuality in any way. And I think that romance empowers women to do the opposite, right? And we don't often see that in a good light in media. Anytime a woman who's written romance gets popular, like their books are portrayed in the media as like fairy porn, or recently we've had dragon porn. And I really think that comes from, you know, a deeply religious background. And, you know, I'm Indigenous, and these beliefs were forced on my people. So like, fuck that. I think like religion is great for society, right? I think it's needed, but I also think that the beauty of writing romance is to challenge those concepts that are actually man-made. So I think that answered your question.
Yeah.
I kind of forgot it as we were
going along,
but
you killed it. How would you guys say that has changed since you've kind of began writing and just began reading romance? Has it changed
in how we like approach
I think, like, in how, and how you approach writing religion within romance, and then maybe how it's perceived as a whole, like, writing religion within romance. How has that changed, or has it changed since you guys started?
For me, I started out with this story in this series because that's what was in my head. It was actually a way for me to address issues in my former religion. I'm actually not Hindu anymore, but my former religion. And it was cathartic for me to be able to, like, express those opinions and to say things that I wasn't able to say in reality because, like, you know, we're supposed to be a bit more submissive and keep your opinions to yourself. That, you know, that's how I was raised. So now I don't do that. I spew my opinions and what I think. So I actually write less and less of it. It was for a purpose when I started out. And I also noticed that so certain publishers were also pigeonholing me into writing more books about that. And it's like, well, just like in real life, we are not just our one, you know, our one part of my life. Like, I'm not just Indian or just Hindu or whatever. I have other things that I want to say. So I actually had to work on breaking away from that. It served a purpose. I don't think I necessarily need to add it to the stories that I'm working on, especially not for IP. But yeah, so I actually write less of it.
I think the way it's changed for me, it's been a really interesting journey. So when I started off writing these books specifically, it was so I am Jewish. I was raised in Libertyville, north of here, even though I live in San Francisco area now. And my husband, who I've known since I was 18, and I'm turning 50 this year, so that tells you something, is Arab American, and he was also raised in the Chicago suburbs. And so I started, I won't go into the whole how I got to the book itself, The Golem and the Genie, but the, like, the impetus of it was sort of taking a look at our heritages, our religious and cultural backgrounds, and sort of setting them parallel and facing each other, like, within the context of American immigration, but putting, like, the spin of fantasy on it. And I've been working on these books since it started in 2005, that I've, like, started the first short story that became The Golem and the Genie. And so my life and my perceptions and my sort of the way that I face and relate to my religious upbringing, you know, it changes, like, over the course of life. I mean, 20 years now, I've had two kids since then. And what it's helped me to do in the writing is sort of as a place to explore different aspects of Judaism in sort of like a, I don't know, scholarship fashion that I one of the reasons it takes me so darn long to write these books is because I do a lot of research. So I sort of felt like I'm indulging my inner, like, master's student, I guess, to just, like, read all of this stuff about Judaism, about, you know, so Lebanese Christianity, Islam at the time, and just incorporate bits of it into the book as I can. And so that's sort of become my religious scholarship in a way. I'm not a I don't practice, you know, I'm a cultural Jew, but I don't belong to synagogue. I don't pray regularly. You know, my kids are not being really raised in a religious tradition. This is where I put it all, is in the book. So it sort of became that outlet for me personally to be able to explore some of that stuff. And less of it makes it into the book than I kind of wanted to, just because all of this stuff is so interesting. And, but, you know, like, little bits here and there, like, one of the most romantic, I was telling Scarlett earlier, I don't have a lot of, like, steam in my books. Like, I tend to be like a pan over to the fireplace sort of, you know, as the light goes down and we're not going to watch, we're going to let them be part of it, you know. But one of the most sort of closest to, like, a romantic scene of a, like, a charged, like, sexy scene in my books comes in The Hidden Palace, and it involves imagery from the mikveh, which is the Jewish ritual bath that women take after it's like after your period. It's like a ritual cleansing and a bath before you can sleep with your husband again. And you also do it, like, the night before you get married. Now, I was raised Reform, never been to a mikveh in my life. If someone told me I had to, I would be deeply offended at the idea that I was unclean. But if you're look, but it, there's like, you get to, when you get to use like the metaphor of it, when you get to use the sort of like claim it as a like a cleansing for one's own purposes of like, well, you know, not so much like, well, now I'm fit to sleep with someone, but this is like a journey that I'm going through in order to feel ready for a new step in a relationship. It was just really cool to be able to use that imagery. Yeah. So I feel some, I'm sort of like a, I get to be a, I'm like a magpie, just steal the stuff. And I'm sorry, I've been talking for too long, you go.
No, I loved it. I thought that was a beautiful comparison, yeah. I think, you know, I've my other series, Hades and Persephone, A Touch of Darkness, is Greek mythology, and that is still people's religion. And I think what's interesting about that is we saw a big rise in retellings. I mean, you write retellings too. And the nice part is that you can rewrite those from a place where the women have power, because in those myths or that religion, the women are always oppressed, even when they have power. You know, we see that with Hera and all of her spats with Zeus. We see that even with like Theseus and Ariadne. And I think a lot of times the women are the true heroes. So I do think that over time we've made that shift to rewriting those stories from a place where the women are the true hero.
I love that, because I think that especially the day and age that we live in now, it's so important for like those own voices type stories. I know just me as a reader, I love to be able to read a story that I can identify with on more than just like a romantic aspect or anything like that. So it's really interesting to see how different all three of your answers are, but that you still are so impactful in all of your own ways. Are there any misconceptions about the religions in your work that you are trying to address or correct? And on the flip side, is that important for you to do in your writing?
I swear I read this question before you asked it, and I had an answer, and now I'm like, what did I think? It's gone.
Vamp. I'll
can
answer.
I look at the question?
So one thing that, it wasn't a surprise to me when I started doing the historical research, but when you think 1899 Lower East Side Judaism, like you sort of picture like Yentl in Manhattan, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a lot of push carts and people singing and eating cabbage soup. And there was a lot of that. But one thing that I wanted to make clear in The Golem and the Genie was like, the huge variety of Judaisms that existed in Manhattan, you know, in America at that time. It was everything from, you know, ultra Orthodox all the way down to a very Jewish atheism that was brought over with like the intellectual set, and all the different gradations that, you know, over time we sort of lose sight of. You know, sort of the way that every generation thinks that they're the ones to invent being edgy, you know, this was true back then. This is true now, the number of different ways there are of being Jewish. The other thing that is a misconception generally that about Arab Americans in the U.S. is thinking that they were all Muslim when the first Arab Americans to come over were Christian, were Maronite Christian and Orthodox Christian from Lebanon, which was back then part of what was called Greater Syria and was part of the Ottoman Empire. And so when they, you know, the people who came over and they settled in Little Syria were for the most part Christian. And I've had people ask me, did you invent Little Syria? Which I did not. God forbid I should do something like that. And the other was, people ask me, well, why did you make them Christian? Because the implication being that I sort of couldn't, I don't know if couldn't deal or didn't want to deal with like pitting Jews and Muslims directly against each other. So I made them Christian. And I'm like, well, that's who they were at the time. Mm. And it's this sort of part of Arab American history that, you know, Arab Americans know about it, but other people tend not to. And so that was sort of like, it was a neat thing that I got to tell people about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love that.
I think it's kind of difficult for me to answer this question because I have a fantasy religion essentially, but it was created, I think, the way all religions are created, which is that you take pieces of the previous religion and say, I like that, and then form, like, you know, your congregation. But I think that, I don't know if it's a misconception exactly, but we have to recognize that the institutions that are responsible for communicating these belief systems, they're very flawed and they have very human people who run them. And they're like, we have so many statistics for, you know, the Catholic Church that talks about a lot of abuse, but we don't have those same statistics for Protestant churches. And that's a problem because there's a lot of abuse that goes on in those churches. So I think like this misconception that there is a misconception that these are places of worship and they are all good, but the people in them, they're still inherently flawed. And when we don't look at the institution as a whole and say like, this is a problem, we need to correct it, we're just encouraging bad things to happening, right? Like I said, again, like I'm not against religion. I consider myself a very spiritual person. I believe in God. But I think when we start to create institutions around religion, they are become methods of control, and we lose the whole purpose of worshiping a God, which is our afterlife, right? And I've been really thinking, that's like an existential crisis I'm having, is like, isn't religion about death, about where you go when you die? And why are we shoving that on everyone, you know, and saying like, oh, this religion is superior. So overall, I think it's not really a misconception, but I think it is a problem. And I think that's kind of what I tried to address in Tara at the Gates.
I didn't really set out to do anything.
Girl, like, you don't have to. Just write a good book.
You know, earlier I mentioned that I had things that I wanted to say that I couldn't say. So that was my intention. But I also like pulled from experiences that I've had and how, you know, I was raised and of how we did things, because Hinduism is a huge religion that has so many different branches and sects to it. And then in India itself is different states where you have different cultures and religions, and then in one city that's near the village that my parents are from will do things completely different, even though they're the same sect or the same religion. So I did have fun, like, for example, in my YA rom-com, My Sister's Big Fat Indian Wedding, of showing like how my family in their part of the religion has done things, and just like showcasing that, because I thought a lot of that was kind of like cool and colorful and fun. And I was happy to hear, I would get messages from readers and say, oh my God, that's, you know, that's exactly how we did it. And we could see ourselves in the book, because you may read books that have other Hindu rituals and traditions, but not this exact one that my family also did, because we're also from that city by the village or wherever we're from. So that was really cool to see that. But on the other hand, I also had readers say, "Oh, that's not how it's done," or "That's not how it is in my temple."
And it's like, I was like, "Who told you were wrong?"
Yeah. That was going to come up. And actually, that was one of my worst fears of writing, even though it's my experience that I was writing from and the things that I personally went through or saw. And my biggest fear was like having other Hindu readers or Indian women read any of my works and say, that's not how it is, or that's not what it's like. I was like, well, that, yeah, so we have that, you know, there's always going to be someone that says that's not how it is, or that's incorrect. But for the most part, I loved hearing from readers to say, that's exactly how it happened for us, or this made me feel like I was back at my own wedding, or this, you know, this forced meet cute for my parents is exactly what happened to me or to my sister, you know. So that is what really made it fun for me and helped me to keep going with all my other writing. And in my YA dark fantasy, which takes Medusa and Persephone, like you were saying earlier, I really had a great time of meshing like Greek mythology and Indian mythology and creating something new, but then also bringing like Medusa has a horrible tragic story, but bringing like the feminist side and giving her power and giving her a voice. And the same thing with Persephone. So that was really fun. So yeah, that was like a completely opposite intention of just like fusing these cultures and these religions together and making something fun and feminist. And
Well, I want to go back to something that that you said about control.
Yeah.
About it, power, you know, institutions of control, and that's because I think that's one of the things that romance it tends to be such a theme in romance is like, who's trying to control you? Mm-hmm. To what end? How are you going to find your truth mm-hmm. inside of like the systems that are working on you or that you are a part of? How much can you get out of that if you want to get out of it? How much can you make it your own and still like, you know, honor the parts of it that you want to while sort of either putting aside or altering for your own purpose the parts of it that don't serve you, you know, and in a romance, like with the purpose of, you know, in the end to be with the other person. But there was an article I was reading recently, I can't remember the details, but they were talking about how much modern romance, people have such a misconception of what like a modern romance novel is, that it's like basically people wanting to, you know, just the point is to get ravished.
It's because they don't read actual romance
exactly.
novels.
Exactly. And it's like, no, the point is self-empowerment. That is like the thing in
for
romance,
sure.
especially like modern romance. And the point, you know, it's like, well, how do you get there? What is that internal journey? And that is like the meat on the bone of this stuff.
Yeah, I love what you said about like, you know, as far as like controlling populations, that's definitely an angle in religion and religion. But I think everyone just wants autonomy. We just want to live how we want to live. And they're like, you know, people use religion to influence how we all live, and that's not fair, and nothing is fair, but we're all just people who want autonomy, who want to live how we live. And what is so wrong with that if we're not hurting other people? And I think we all can kind of relate to that right now in our current environment. And I think that's why I like latch on to that concept of control, because one of the things Lilith wants is just autonomy. She doesn't care what your belief systems are. It's chill. Believe whatever you want, you know, but don't force me into that little hole.
Can I add to
that? Yes, go for
to
it.
To both of you guys, because you had mentioned romance bringing empowerment to women, and you're mentioning like how, you know, the characters will perceive religion and how you're breaking out of that. So like in my debut novel, The Trouble with Hating You, we have the main character who is like against religion because it's hurt her so much. And then we have her love interest who's part of the religion, but not like totally into it, but you know, he's still part of that community. He has that respect. And I have heard from so many readers say like, this has opened my eyes to how a man can be. So like the empowerment and having the autonomy, like that's the power of romance novels, is that you can see how men or a significant other should treat you, and not, and like, we don't have to settle for this. So I mean, I just love going back and reading these messages. Like I learned that I don't have to settle for this kind of man, and that my main character's his name is Jay Shaw. So like my Jay Shaw's out there somewhere. And,
oh my God,
oh, I love that.
It gets better. Okay, it gets better. you know, my Jay Shaw's out there. This has leveled up the standards for men, for brown men, whatever, et cetera. But okay, so I was tagged in this this TikTok, and this reader, she was saying like, I read this book and I met this guy named Jay Shaw, and I realized I'm not gonna settle for less. If I don't find a Jay Shaw, that's it. And she found a Jay Shaw, and that's
I
his
love
name.
That.
Yes,
his name is literally.
It. Yes, that's literally his name.
She
Jay Shaw.
You wrote this man into
sure
existence.
Did.
And I expect
that's
a
wild.
Wedding. I expect a wedding invitation.
You, yes, as you
I
should.
But I just like love that. I love knowing
I love that
something that I wrote that I just thought I was writing for fun or for myself has made an impact on someone in several ways. But it's like that's cool. Like I raised your standards.
I love that.
No, I think that's so beautiful, everything that you guys said, because obviously like I'm not a writer, but I am the front face that's selling all of these books. And I feel like especially now more than ever, like people come into the store wanting a book that they can see themselves in or question things that they're going through. Or, you know, like we get people who ask, like, I'm really thinking of switching my religion, or like, I am dating someone who is from a different culture. Like, do you have books that talk about that? And I'm like, we do. Like, I think these own voices and books that, excuse my language, but talk about the hard shit is really important. And I think romance has been changing so much with that, that there's even books that I'm like,
I would have never thought about something that way. And now I have to sit with this book and really just take it all in and embrace it. So what representations of religion do you guys see in the romance genre that speak to you personally? And do you guys have any models or inspirations for when you're writing your own stuff about it? No, it's a loaded question. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, this is a hard one for me.
Yeah.
The only romance book I read with religion in it was Sierra Simone's Priest. And we all know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that there's that. I don't know what that says about me.
But I'm co-signing that whole
but
statement.
I love so. Sierra. She's fantastic. And
I'm getting Rex from you later.
Yeah, no. Sierra, I love her take on it. It's so funny. I've done so many events with her. I said, I can answer it. She always gets the question, like, what was your motivation to write this, you know, basically Catholic, it's kind of a Catholic romance. Yeah. And but she talks about how, like, being Catholic, I'm not Catholic, my husband's Catholic, but, you know, it's a very, like, body thing. It's very, like, physical. And she feels, like, sensual. And she translated that into a very hot novel about a very hot priest. And there are some things that happen in that church that, you know, that maybe God would approve of. I mean, he does say go forth and bear fruit, right? Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's very brave of her to do that. She, but it really resonates with people because there's a lot of Catholic guilt out there. There's a lot of guilt, fill in the blank for any, you know, religion. But I think, you know, and Sierra, she's just a wonderful example of a feminist who writes really feminist work that's very sexy. And a big reason why I think I felt comfortable to write Terror at the Gates. You know?
She wrote it so long ago. And yeah. I think that it was still such a taboo thing around romance when she wrote it. So to not only write a romance novel, but to write it in the way that she did and stick by it was so just admirable. Like even now I'm sure she probably gets like crazy messages, but she stood 10 toes down and I appreciate that about
her.
The
other thing about Sierra is that we'll have to tell her. We talked all about her tonight. She's very intelligent. She's an academic. And a lot of times when women write romance, they think we're not smart. And I'm like, you can have a romance book that has a lot of sex and says a lot of important things.
Absolutely.
And if you're not reading it, you can't have an opinion on it. It drives me nuts. You cannot have an opinion on something that you have not experienced for yourself. And so many people do. So if you haven't read Priest by Sierra Simone, I highly recommend that. She should be on this panel too. They probably asked her. I don't know. She's probably writing something.
I love that there is that misconception that romance writers are just like, I don't know, housewives and don't have anything going on.
There are a ton that are lawyers, doctors.
You know, I was just gonna say, I've been in the rom-com author space for a long time. And
Allie?
I know a lot of authors and like Allie, she has a PhD in neurobiology. I know, a cardiac surgeon who just got into writing romance novels. I know so many lawyers that are romance novels, so many professors, and it's like, okay, I'm just going to start addressing you as doctor. And I tell people like in the audience, okay, this isn't a doctor. You got to call her Dr. So-and-so. Yeah, it's really about that empowerment in like writing your story. But I guess going back to your question, I don't really look at the religion when I'm picking up a book. Mm-hmm. That's not something that I'm searching for when I'm picking up a book. Like, I read a romance novel recently, and it was about Hanukkah, and I was like, oh, that's great. But that was, like, the background of the story, and I was like, oh, that's really cool.
Was that the matzo ball?
Yeah.
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 It's on my TBR.
Yeah. Sometimes the religion aspect comes up, but it's not the main plots of the story. It's not, the thing that I'm going for. But I'm also a wide reader. Like, I love horror and, like, sci-fi. Like, I'm big into thrillers and, like, dark stuff. And religion oftentimes comes up, and it's like, oh, that's cool. Like, or maybe I learned something, even though that's not the intention of having religion in a fiction novel usually. But yeah, I don't look for it.
It's funny. I was thinking because we got these questions ahead of time, but I was trying to think beforehand. It's like, okay, what religious romance, like, what has influenced me? And it kept coming back to a couple different things. One was fantasy and the way that fantasy world building can stand in for religion so much that it's more like a an outward, you know, sort of visible in the world, metaphorical sort of embodiment of mm-hmm. what in religion is unseen and internal. There's a romance, I guess it's romanticy out that got a year or two ago called A Taste of Golden Iron.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I can't remember the author's name, and it's killing me right now, but it's a gay fantasy with the slowest burn, but it's all about, it's sort of about beliefs. The thing that connects these two is like, and it's like enemies to lovers, sort of, but they have these really intense conversations about fealty and like a moral code between a like a subject and a ruler. And it's like this, and I'm like, oh shit, that's my jam. That's what gets me going, is like, I end up having like all of, and I was thinking about it, like all of the romance books or books with like where I get really into the romance, it's where the two people argue a lot or have a lot of like, it's banter. It's about like coming to an understanding. Mm-hmm. It's about like realizing that you do align in a deep way that makes sort of that's more important than the sort of surface stuff. Has anyone read Dorothy Sayers, the Lord Peter Wimsey mystery novels? Her characters, she has this Lord Peter Wimsey is he's sort of like an upper crust British toff who solves mysteries. And like halfway through the series, which she wrote in like the 1920s up to the 30s, she introduces this female journalist mystery sleuth named Harriet Vane. And the two of them, it's like this immediate sort of like, they're immediately into each other, but they can't be, you know, she doesn't want to get married. She wants to be independent and he's too wealthy for her and blah, blah, blah. And then she writes this book called Gaudy Knight. That is the hottest intellectual romance where it's these two, they're solving a mystery together at Oxford, and half of the book is them sitting and arguing. And I could read it over and over and over and over again. And I think, and this is gonna sound like the weirdest bridge ever, but so much of what gets to me about like Judaism that I'm interested in is the whole concept of arguing, of like you are arguing with the text, you are arguing with God, you are arguing with your entire family, you're arguing with everyone, and that is how you get. That is like in some ways how community is formed. It's also how community is broken apart, but it's like a central thing. And just sort of taking those two concepts of like, okay, religion and romance, and this is like my love language is arguing, and then I've put it into these books. I'm like, oh, is this me? Is this like a portrait of me? So I don't know what to do with all that, but I'm just going to give it to you. You figure out what to do with it. But okay. No, it's just like,
this
what?
Is their, yes. Your author.
Is that the
Alexandra
cool, the best?
Roland.
Alexandra Roland.
A Taste of Golden
and
Iron.
Whoever did the cover
I
on that book.
It. You guys have seen this before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
I was like, you would know.
Yeah. Like, I'm like, she, the artist got the two of them. It's like, you read the book, and it's like, yes, those are those
They're
two.
They're really hot.
And they are very hot. And it is a fantastic
That's
book.
Important.
Yes, it is. It is.
Well, thank you guys so much. It has just been so insightful to hear from you all. And we are going to open up to audience Q&A.
I didn't really want to go first, but so I'm thinking about like this moment we're living in full of book bans and people being really sensitive about religion. And I'm wondering if you have gotten any pushback from readers or from editors about how you approach religion, since it's like not totally conventional, maybe?
So I think, okay, so as a writer, especially being BIPOC, I make a very strong effort to make sure that I'm not offensive to people, because I don't want to put out anything that's hurtful or harmful. And I know not a lot of authors do that, but I feel like that's my responsibility. And also, I would feel horrible if someone just messages me and is like, this is so hateful, or whatever the case is. I do a lot of research ahead of time, and then my editors usually also will like catch something that's like, maybe you should use a different phrasing, or like this word is actually mean something that's harmful or whatever. So, not to use the word woke, but That's kind of how my editors are. And so like between the two of us, we make a great deal to be more conscientious, I guess, of what readers might take away.
I keep waiting for the pushback. And I it hasn't come, I think, possibly because my books are just sort of weird enough that people don't quite know what to do with like these two fantastical monsters who are strolling around. But I'm waiting. I think looking ahead to, like, you know, I've got the third book in the series coming out next year. Things are a little touchy right now in the Jewish community, in the Arab American community, in the very divided Jewish community at the moment, with also a very real rise in anti-Semitism that is, you know, popping back up. And, you know, Gaza is like the specter that hangs over everything. And so that's going to be interesting to deal with when that happens. Who knows where we'll be this time next year with that. But it's just something that weighs on my heart, weighs on a lot of, you know, on everyone's hearts. And I think it's going to, it just sort of comes out in strange ways, in arenas that aren't built for it. And so, yeah, I'm just sort of like mindful. I'm trying to be mindful of, you know, how to respond to that.
Yeah, I haven't had any pushback from readers. We had a sensitivity read done on the book just in case. I obviously, like you said, I always want to be very respectful. The concern came with the cover and symbolism on the cover and it being too literal. And I disagreed. You know, serpents are present in all lots of religions. These are things that are inherent, not just in Christianity, because the fear was in the current environment offending Christians. And I just feel like, you know, I was very thorough in my research. I have references in the back of my book. I have an extensive author's note. And yeah, but I also think that it's important to have those conversations. So if it is a conversation piece, then, you know, I think that's also important.
Following along the same vein, I wondered, hearing all three of you talk, has the current, I don't know what to call it, I guess, American climate inspired you to use your voices, use your talent in writing to create a discourse around a perception into other religions, perhaps, you know, opening up and introduction to other religions, providing different perspectives. You know, I was told by someone who is a psychiatrist that he's a big believer in that if you get two people who have polar opposite views, throw them in the same room, have them talk it out and hash it out, and he fully believes that good will come of that. Unfortunately, social media has told me otherwise, so I would be interested in hearing, you know, from writers whether you feel inspired by the current climate to use your voices and use your talent to kind of push a little bit of intelligent and progressive thinking, or critical thinking at least.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's what I did with Terror at the Gates. It was very important for me to, what you said about social media is very interesting to me, but I'm gonna turn it to the concept of feminism, because I've read an article recently about how social media has corrupted the definition of feminism, and it has become this idea of man-hating. And when I release this book, the dedication is to the women who were told they have to submit to the dominance of man. And a woman was like, that sounds like feminist bullshit. And I was like, you don't understand the definition of feminism. Mm-hmm. And you defaulted to assuming I was talking about sex, because she was like, you can't, you know, pretend that we wouldn't want Hades or Adrian, two of my other characters, to dominate us. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with that, but you really like willfully misunderstood this dedication. And I think it's because her definition of feminism comes from the internet. And as a librarian, I'm like, please read real academic anything about what feminism is, because in this current environment, right, we could lose these rights that the ones we're like barely holding on to right now as women, and you know, as anyone, right, we're facing that, we have faced that, and it's stupid to not acknowledge it, and that's what I hope Tara does. I hope it really encourages people to take a critical look at what rights we have and may lose. And it's so interesting to me too, because I wish that people who participate in all religion would recognize, but especially in the States, when it's being used as a political weapon against you, and you, I don't know if you're just really interested in having your ethics shoved onto everyone or like what, but it's, they don't actually believe what you believe. They're manipulating you. And I was very much in that mind, like that headspace while I was writing Tear at the Gates. I hope it does encourage conversation, and I hope people can see what is really happening. It feels like we're almost in a cult, you know? We'll see. That felt depressing.
Well, like so many things these days.
Yeah, right?
You know, okay, so I have sort of like an immediate answer to that, which is every time I try to write to a point, every time I try to write to make a point, it doesn't work. It falls sort of, it lands with a thud. You know, there's a certain, I don't want to say, it's like when you read an Aesop's fable and it's like, well, that was written just to tell me to sit up straight and eat my vegetables, sort of. And I've never been good at writing to make that sort of statement. What I prefer to do is ask questions. And I think sometimes it comes down to asking the right questions, wrestling with the answers, and making it okay not to know. Because that is what so much of these religion, like the, whether you want to call it like the dominant sort of religious fervor, the clamping down of options, the clamping down against LGBT validity, any sort of like that, it's, are you allowed to question or not? Or are you following dogma? Mm-hmm. And that's that, the idea of curiosity, the idea of, like you said, you know, allowing people to believe different things is like, mm-hmm, the path, and you see it in every religion. Every religion, mm-hmm, has its zealots. And it's like, if when the path gets narrower and narrower to the point where it's like, if you are not just following this straight line, if you deviate, if you do anything that means you might deviate from one, you know, to one, you know, and just sort of like fall off this very narrow ledge that we have defined for you, that's when it all just becomes so restrictive, and you know, the rights just sort of get peeled off one by one. And so presenting diversity of thought, diversity of religion, diversity of experience is something that I have tried to do with these books. So I, mm-hmm, think my current response is just to keep doing what I've been doing, because I don't, like, I'm in the middle of this, you know, this project that is going to end next year. And after that, it's going to be like, well, what do I do now? And I think that's when I'm going to have to start asking those questions, sort of like, okay, what do I do now? Like, well, how do I create something that is going to encompass, how do I create something else that's going to encompass all of this and also like speak to the present moment in a way that doesn't fall flat? And so that's going to be like my giant, you know, problem going forward.
You can do it. I believe in you.
I do. I've felt such rage over things that they come across in the book. It may be subtle, it may be an entire plot line, like FAFO, you know, like, you know, F around and find out.
Yeah.
But it's not really toward religion, it's toward feminism. Like you said, feminism is just about, we just don't want a boot on our necks. Like, we're not asking to dominate men the way that they dominate us. We just, right, want to get that boot off of our neck. And, you know, hearing these men, especially after this last election, saying, you know, we own you, and seeing men, like, actually at, I went to University of Texas, and there were people there with signs that says things that we own, you know, homes, cars, women, things like that. I do address those things in my writing, and I will have my characters react the way that I wish I could react, which is probably violently. I'm not actually going to do that, but it feels good to get that out on page. And also to, like, hopefully if someone who believes that reads it, they can see what it's like to be on the other side. And in A Drop of Venom, my Medusa retelling, Medusa is a victim of sexual assault. Like, that's her entire origin story. And seeing her come from a place in the book where people are equal, men, women, non-gender, everyone is equal, coming into a kingdom because they're refugees now, a kingdom took over their area and is a horrible patriarchy. And she is stripped of her rights. She is asked questions like, well, what were you wearing? What were you doing? You know, you don't talk to men like this way. You don't do this, you don't do that, simply because you're a woman. And having these things expressed in writing, and I've had young men, young men approach me saying that they've read that book and they completely relate to her, even though they're not a victim or of assaults, they're not a woman. But they're like, just opened my eyes to so much that women have to go through and to see things like that. So now they make steps to be a safe space and to address things. Like, if a woman hasn't told you that she's a victim of something, that means maybe she doesn't trust you enough. Because as women, I can guarantee you that, like, at least 75% of us are victims of something horrible like that. And
I think, sorry, the default is not to trust the men.
Yes.
And that's, and men don't understand that.
Yes.
And it's nothing, it's like, well, why didn't she feel she could trust me? Like, that's what we do. We don't trust you until we know that we can.
So my love interest in the book is actually the version of Perseus, who is the guy in Greek mythology who beheaded Medusa while she was sleeping, of course, and still used her body after her death to, like, turn the Kraken into stone and save another woman. My editor did point out, she's like, we just don't want to use the phrasing where we want to hate all men, you know, like, not all men are like this, because obviously the love interest is not like that.
Hashtag not so, all men.
So again, to, like, you know, the whole feminism thing is like, it's not about hating all men. It's just, we just don't want the boot on our neck. So,
yeah,
I mean, yes. Yeah. So anyway, to answer your question, yes, it comes out. It comes out in the book.
We've been talking about a lot of stuff like around religion. It's like religion ends up being the crucible for all of this, right? It's like, this is where it gets all concentrated.
And again, like you were saying, it's not necessarily like that a religion is bad, or that, you know, so many people are religious or part of a religion, and not all those people are bad. But it's when you use religion as a way to dominate other people, that's when it becomes something bad.
We've got time for one more question.
This might be a little bit of like a deeper question. I don't know, whatever, I shouldn't compare. But how do you think that writing can be used as like a tool against fundamentalism, especially like writing about religion, since it can kind of simultaneously like promote religion, but then also like criticize it? So where do you think those intersect?
I think one thing about fundamentalism is it is inherently boring. There is, and I say that, I mean, like as a, just as a base level, there's no diversity of anything. There's no diversity of, like, when you talk about, like, I mean, it's almost like inherent in the name, fundamental. Like, it's everyone has to be down to, like, these six things that we believe to be true, and you're not allowed to add a seventh, right? You're not allowed to delete one of them. And so just to write a story that tells life as it is, it tells life as in all its messiness, in all its like self-contradiction, I think ends up being a blow against, but a rejoinder to that. A like, no, but life isn't like that. And you're trying to make life like a thing that it isn't. And so I think, presenting options, like you've talked about someone reading one of your books and saying, I didn't know there were men like that out there. I think writing about religion as it is lived, and maybe someone who's in a restrictive situation manages to read that book and says, oh, there's other ways to be a Christian. There's other ways to be a Jew. There's other ways to be whatever. That's something, you know, all we can do is tell stories in the end. You know, that's, I think trying to approach it from a more tactical direction, I think you end up tying yourself in knots, you know, because what you, as writers, when we try to, like, sort of like what I was saying before, like writing with the aim of making a point, you do end up sort of tying yourself in knots. And it's like, sometimes you end up not being true to the thing that you were trying to talk about in the first place. And so if that thing that you're trying to talk about is just real life as it is lived, and that includes religion and that includes feminism, that includes trying to figure out belief in a personal way that maybe fits inside a system, but making that system your own, as well as honoring the system, you know, that's existed before, just to write that as it is striking a blow for diversity, because that's the sort of story some people don't want to hear.
Yeah, I think it's challenging because, you know, we can write the stories, but if you're in this group of people, you're probably not reading them, you know, and that's the challenge, is getting those books into those people's hands, or even, you know, because they have to be in a place where they receive that information and where they're ready to hear it. So I think it's a bigger challenge. I think that most people change when they're able to go off to college. But if you go to a religious college, or, you know, that just encourages that fundamentalism, it's going to be very hard. Unfortunately, a lot of times trauma changes people's minds. I like to think that I can change people's, like, view of other people via my novels, but I am also very aware, as I was a librarian, that access is difficult.
I think that's, like, a great segue into, like, book bans.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Reading is very important. Books are very important. Mm-hmm. You open your eyes to historical things, like bad things that happen. We don't want to repeat it. You open your eyes to someone else who's walked a different way of life, or maybe mm-hmm. gone through the same things that you have, but have been able to deal with it differently. And you're like, oh, there's a better way to deal with this, or there's mm-hmm. there's an opportunity to actually heal from these things. And yeah,
well, but Florida's like, really fighting those book bans.
Yeah, but again, like the book ban, and then also not getting their books into the hands of certain readers. Like it's a struggle. It's a struggle for sure.
I think it's just a difficult thing, but your readers. And the more you talk about the books you love, and you, that's, readers read what their friends are reading. The end.
When you have kids, give the kids books.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for this incredible conversation. But first, how about a round of applause for our panelists?
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.